most famous performances of Theme and Variations is Glenn Gould's landmark 1955 recording of the massive Goldberg Variations of Johann Sebastian Bach. What are the advantages of writing variations for composers? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
And for that matter, what are the advantages of those themes and variations that are so plentiful when it comes to the performer and the audience? Our guest is Bill McLaughlin, composer, conductor, music educator, and Peabody Award-winning host and music director of the public radio programs Exploring Music and St. Paul Sunday, which is America's most widely listened to weekly classical music program produced by public radio and airs on approximately 200 stations nationwide.
Welcome to University of the Year.
I'm delighted to be here and meet the two of you. I met Norman earlier today, but it's great to meet you, Emily.
Great. It's great to have you here in Madison. What intrigues you about this form, theme and variations?
Well, you know, on the one hand, theme and variations seems like a child's form. You thought I could play the piano and play the middle register. I'd say, okay, man, I'll make birdies. They play up high. They play something a little dumb and make thunder. It seems like it's that elemental. We all make variations. So you make a variation when you walk to school. You take a different path. It's probably the most elemental thing that people do when they don't want to repeat their steps exactly. But the interesting thing is, can I tell a quick story? Mm-hmm. It comes from Milan Kundera, a book, The Book of Laughter and Forgetting. And there's a scene. Kundera's father was a pianist, very well known in Prague, especially as a teacher. Rudolf Verkuzny knew him, he told me. So in the scene in the book, the man is old. He's had a stroke, and he can't any longer play the piano. But every day he goes into a studio, opens the door, sits down at the piano, and turns the pages of this music that he used to play. And one day Kundera's coming in to visit his pop, and his pop's weeping. And he says, oh, no, did you have another stroke? What's going on? And the old man can barely get out. I understand. He manages to get those words across. And he's pointing at the last pages of Beethoven, Opus 111, the last sonata, which is a variation form. And this sets Kundera off on this great thing. He says, variations is, in a way, the deepest form. It occupies the greatest composers, particularly at the end of their lives. The last 10 years of Bach, Art of the Fugue, you can even think of Well-Tempered Clavier as a series of variations on an idea, musical offering. There's so many variations. And Kundera says, symphony form, sonata form. There's Joseph Haydn, like, you know, the explorer cook, going across the Pacific Ocean exploring new territory, but on the surface. Now, variations is different. We take a flower and we examine it really closely, and we maybe put on our $6 specs and look at it a little more closely. Then you put on a microphone and then under electric, and by each step, you're looking at the same flower, but you're going deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. He said, and that's what variations does. And I feel like, he said, now I'm starting to understand my father. I've come to see him how many times? I've heard him play Opus 111. He can't play it anymore, but I can hear it resounding in his head. Mm-hmm. So I think when you hear this music, think of that. You're going deeper and deeper, even if it's a child's theme.
Those variations that we started with, Glenn Gould, back in 1955, playing the Goldberg Variations, but he reperformed the Goldberg Variations many years later, and to this day, people are arguing which is better.
Actually, I like them both. The variation we just heard, because I've heard the second recording more recently, that variation sounds almost a little brisk to me. It's much, much quicker. When he came back, he recorded so slowly. Sometimes it's almost too slow to listen to, but it's like going to see Kundera's father, and he's taking his, you go to visit your old uncle, you know, and he takes these precious artifacts off the shelf, and he shows them, and he turns them to the light, and you see another facet, and he turns them to the light again. That's what Gould's doing with the later stuff. It's not performance for a concert hall. It's performance for celestial.
Which you hear occasionally said of Bach.
Yeah.
Should we listen to more of it? And before we do, can you tell us sort of what kinds of things to listen for?
Well, actually, to tell the truth, what we're going to hear is the theme. And not the variation, but the theme is so exquisite. And what we'll hear is a bass line that is actually the base of the variations. Just pay attention to what his left hand is doing. The right hand's very pretty, but it's just like a, you hear a thing that could fit into Ray Charles, but it's here in Bach.
Thank you.
And what about that theme made it sort of ripe for variation then?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is the Goldberg for whom Bach was composing this piece was a keyboard player who played for Prince who had trouble with insomnia. So Bach wrote his buddy Goldberg variations that seemed endless, and he could play the Prince to sleep each night. Each one of these variations is not only fairly long on its own, it's got repeats built in. So if he's still not nodding off, it's like when you get the little kid, you can't quite get a kid to go down, play it again.
And the Goldberg variations will go on for 50 minutes as it is.
It can, but it's so beautiful. I mean, that's part of the reason. There are some things, you can take a quick shower or you can sink into a warm bath, it's a whole different experience.
Presumably, composers also like to take another composer's work and do variations or sort of do their own take on that earlier composer's work.
Yeah, that's a kind of homage. There's a great deal of honor. So we were talking about the piece that's called, by Brahms, called Variations on a Theme of Joseph Haydn. Haydn did use this thing. It's actually an old Austrian hymn tune, Chorale to St. Anthony. And Haydn used it in a string piece, a field partita, he called it, for, you know, like a little military band playing for the Kaiser. And Brahms took this tune. The great thing about the theme is it has an uneven even phrase length. It goes, dum dum dum, two measures, dum, three, dum, da-da-da-da-da, five measures. Nothing's 5 measures long. All classical music is twos and fours, but it's a three and a two, it's a five, and he does it again. And in the variations, Brahms sticks to that thing. I think it's one of the things that fascinated him about this old tune. So I think maybe we should hear the theme itself, and we'll have to confer while we're doing that. We're going to get you a couple of the variations. This is a really big piece. We'd use up most of the rest of our time. But here's theme borrowed from Haydn, who borrowed it himself, and then a couple of variations by Brahms.
Thank you.
George Zell and Cleveland with their take on some of those variations.
Doesn't get any better than that. It's beautiful. Okay, we did a little violence to the form. This is Brahms' variations on the theme of Joseph Haydn, and we had the opening and the first two variations. And then my favorite variation is that lovely sort of almost sentimental slow dance, 6-8 dance in the center. And there's a great sort of fugato finale, but that would take more time than we have today. You were an oboist.
Yeah, a lot of nice oboe parts in this.
Yeah, do you remember playing the piece?
Mm-hmm.
It comes back.
Yep.
Yeah.
Is there a kind of a standard way to progress in themes? I mean, that you would start with something of a certain, well, the original theme, of course.
Yeah.
But then is there kind of a typical way that a composer would go through variations?
That's an extremely good question. I think it varies because the composer may have, if it's a virtuoso piece, you may want your first variation to be really flashy and show off all your tricks. And then probably having done that, you'll need to calm down. You see what I mean?
Sure,
and then
yeah.
Build that up again at the end. Somebody else, more contemplative frame of mind, might start very gently, even pull it back from where the composer was and then build it and then make it more complex. If it had been a key in the major key as the Brahms was, he might move it to a minor as he does and then come back to major, move it from 2-4 to 6-8 to whatever. All those kinds of things.
Do you think that the appeal for a composer is in part almost like showing off, look at what I can do, look at my range, just a way for an actor to do different impressions?
Right.
You know? It's like, oh, look at all the different tricks in my bag.
Look at the range. I'm sure that you're right about that. And there's also a kind of simple sincerity about thinking, this piece is so beautiful. What's the next thing I could do? It's almost like when you're in a role as a composer, you're not sitting there thinking it up. It actually does feel like it's coming from somewhere else. And part of the thing as a young composer is you have to learn not to ignore that, because too often it will remind you of somebody else's music. If you've been around music, you know all the tunes. You know, and so you go, oh, no, man, I'm starting to write like Michel Legrand. But you know what? Michel Legrand didn't write the second part of that phrase. And you could look at Mozart and Beethoven and see the same thing. They both went da-dee-da-da-da. But past that, one is Bastien and Bastiana, and the other is Eroica Symphony.
So in a sense, a lot more music is theme and variations than is acknowledged, because composers are consciously or subconsciously playing off of bits that have been done before.
Right. Schoenberg used to say that what he loved best about Brahms was perpetual variation, so that even in the symphonic form, when Brahms at the end of the first movement has a section called recapitulation, he's coming back to the music at the beginning, he never does it the same way quite. He changes the orchestration, he'll change the key, he'll change the register. And Schoenberg particularly loved that. It sort of set up the 20th century for him.
What about a composer known to be a sort of virtuoso show-off like Paganini?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the whole point. You can pick the silliest tune or slightest tune or a child's tune and have people stand on their heads before you're done screaming your name.
And Paganini, on the other hand, wrote those 24 short caprices for solo violin, and the last of them, the 24th, for some reason has really captured the imagination of several major composers who did variations on it.
Oh, yeah. It seems inescapable. It's like catnip for these guys.
One of the best, says I, at least one of the most immediately appealing would be Rachmaninoff.
Oh, yeah. Very. It's a rhapsody, he calls it, a theme of Paganini, but it's based on that tune. And, of course, you know, the great slow tune in Rachmaninoff. Paganini goes, dum da di da dim, and Rachmaninoff at the slow tune turns it upside, goes, dee da 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 dum. It's the same tune upside down.
In that 18th variation.
Yeah.
the famous 18th variation from the Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini by Sergei Rachmaninoff. The pianist was Mikhail Pletnev, and Libor Peshek led the Philharmonia Orchestra. We'll look at an instance of theme and variations in which the variation is actually describing a person when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Bill McLaughlin, who is walking us through some notable examples of a very popular device for composers over the centuries. That would be the theme and variations.
Yeah.
There's a notable set of variations which to this day remain enigmatic.
Well put. It's Everett Elgar, who's he always described himself as the son of a piano tuner. And in fact, there was one time when he was invited to the, I think it was the Diamond Jubilee for Queen Victoria. She was still around. And he said, "Madam, you would not like your august presence ruined by the presence of a piano teacher's son and his wife." He wouldn't go. And this was already Sir Edward Elgar at this time. He was a very shy man. But there was one time she writes the story. She said he came home one day, sat at the piano. An idea had come in his head. He was making a walk. He just played a tune. He said, "Well, what if our friend Dora Bell, how would she play that? And then what about our friend the stockbroker?" And he started playing it. That's the basis of Enigma Variations. They're portraits of my friends based on this one theme. And they're all given sort of cryptic titles. They're code names.
Right. He calls himself last. Edo, his nickname. But the most commonly excerpted one is Nimrod. What is it that makes that one so
Nimrod
engaging?
You're better at this. It's the classical hunter, wasn't it? In the Greek mythology, Nimrod is a... And Nimrod, so that's a joke on the name of his publisher, a man named Jaeger, which is hunter in German.
Oh, yeah.
So all the titles are sort of plays on words and little inside jokes.
Yeah, so the people around him would recognize it, but maybe he wouldn't expose his friends to, you know, be
direct,
the newspaper.
Direct exposure, but this is a little more cryptic.
But Jaeger and I can imagine these two old birds sitting out for a summer evening smoking these big, awful cigars, you know, and imagine the glow of the cigars on the porch and... Jaeger, after a certain point, would start to speak about Beethoven adagios, about the profundity of them, which they both admired. I think that's what's reflected in this music, the beautiful adagio. So we're actually going to play the variation which comes just before Nimrod because it goes directly into it. They suspend a G in the violins, and it seems like music time stops, and then this wonderful slow music. In England, instead of the Barber adagio for a moment of great loss, they played Nimrod.
Thank you.
What a beautiful piece. I can see why you say that's used sometimes for sort of solemn occasions.
Yeah, state funerals, any kind of solemnity. And it's such a... We were thinking as we were listening to it, the three of us, that he uses again and again these falling sevens. He keeps going, and it's like a sigh.
Rising and falling.
Built into the music.
That was the Montreal Symphony, Charles Dutoit conducting Nimrod from the Enigma Variations.
You mentioned that you enjoyed conducting this. How
yeah, I always loved the, you know, I played it with William Steinberg. And it's funny, there was this weird affiliation, not weird, it was historically there between the English throne and the German people. They still thought, you've got our king sitting on
That's
there.
That's right.
You know, and Steinberg had grown up George from 1900. Steinberg loved Elgar's music, and he did Elgar so well, did Falstaff so well. But I really learned Enigma Variations from him. And he would play it so freely in such a playful way. He was an old German guy, but he was a German-Jewish old guy with a sense of humor.
Each conductor actually would have a fair amount of latitude, wouldn't he or she, in performing the Enigma Variations. How do you interpret this character?
Yeah. And it float at the top. Or you could do it just exactly the opposite. And that would also be beautiful if you believed it.
One composer we haven't talked about who obviously loved themes and variations and playing around would be Mozart. Tell us about what Mozart does with this form.
Oh, he's famous for playing. I mean, he was a fantastic improviser. Both he and Beethoven were known for the ability to sit down and take anybody's tune. Like somebody would walk in. Actually, Mozart made an enemy of Salieri when he saw Salieri walked in the room, and Salieri had written this kind of corny little march. And Mozart is sitting at the keyboard, made a mockery of it. Very, very funny. It's the kind of thing like, you know, just the way somebody can catch your walk.
Right.
And Salieri didn't appreciate it, but everyone else did. And so he was famous for that. It's fun when he turns his hand to childlike themes. And that's a childlike behavior of which Mozart was guilty some of the time. Same guy that wrote Magic Flute and the C minor Mass also could be a goofball.
So Mozart could take a theme like what we think of as Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star.
Right.
They called it A Vous Dirai-je, Maman. And turned it into some very classy, easily recognizable variations.
Let's dip in.
That was Ingrid Haebler with variations, A Vous Dirai-je, Maman, famous ones by Mozart, also done later, 20th century, by Dohnányi and his variations on a nursery song.
I forgot
big
that.
Big grand concerto-style thing, big, big build-up, you know, orchestra swelling and all this, and then I think it's just one finger, one note, is it?
When the piano comes in, it sounds like a little kid trying out his first tune at home, which is funny. It does make you laugh. It's the idea. But then it becomes very grand once again.
And he does, goes through a series, Dohnányi does, of various styles, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. Almost like before it's over, it sounds like a silent movie theme for a while, and then it kind of comes to a more elegant conclusion.
What about theme and variations for chamber groups, for string quartets, or other sort of little groups?
Staple. Beethoven quartets from the first set of Opus 18 has a variation in it. And I think you guys have lined up some Schubert. Is that what we have here?
We have. We have a couple of chamber music works by Schubert. One is the Trout, which is based on the song of that name, at mm-hmm. least the theme and variations that we get in the fourth of the five movements. Very clearly Di Fiorella.
You know, it's such a charming piece. Do you remember the story, though, that this man is watching the angler on the other side of the stream. He's fishing for the trout, and the trout's too wary. It's clear stream, and he can see the lure. So then the angler dips his boot in, muddies the water, catches the trout. Wretched perfidy.
That's right.
But it's a great song.
Beautiful, shiny thing that's admired when it's brought out into the sunlight by the poet or the person of the poetic sensitivity. And all of this in about a two-minute song that Schubert builds into this wonderfully songful set of variations in the Trout Quintet.
Thank you.
some of the theme and variations from the piano quintet in A. That's the Trout Quintet of Schubert. The pianist was James Levine. The violinist was Gerhard Hetzel. The violist, Wolfram Christ. Georg Faust was the cellist, and playing the double bass, Alois Posch.
Tell us about how, in that case, Schubert makes use of the different timbres of the instruments, the different, you know, the range of the instruments in order to carry out the variations.
Well, you know, it's fun because there are a number of piano quintets which all use two violins, viola, cello, plus the piano. This one uses double bass. And one of my friends in the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, Fred Brechka, you probably know him, told me one time his favorite variation is what he calls the shark variation. It's the variation for the bass.
The bass players have to have that sense of humor too, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, another example, which we will hear a little bit of from the works, the chamber music works of Schubert, is the other extreme, and that's Death and the Maiden. Death and the Maiden, that's based on a song also, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a beautiful song, and Death is calling to the Maiden saying, come on with me. You can rest safely in my arms. I'm ashamed that I can't remember the poem. It could be Goethe, but it's or Heine. We'll have to look. I'm just a little miss right now. But it's a very somber poem, but there's a sense at the end of some sort of rest, at least. I mean, we say rest in peace, and there's feeling a little bit of that. The amazing thing was that song came first, and then Schubert in this quartet crafted as his second movement. He moved it up from D minor to G minor, this beautiful set of variations for his strings. It's angelic and a little scary sometimes.
That was the Tokyo String Quartet with an excerpt from Death and the Maiden, another example of theme and variations, in this case from the works of Franz Schubert, who wrote a lot of themes and variations of one kind or another. We'll look at some other composers who have favored that oft-used device of theme and variations when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Bill McLaughlin, and we are talking about theme and variations in music. I would think the whole idea of taking a theme and having different instruments take over or just running with it, riffing on it, would be at the heart of jazz.
You got that right. The famous player Ornette Coleman said, "Man, most of life is just riffing on your mistakes," which I love because you take what happened. And in jazz, it's like basketball. You know, like, okay, well, you can't tell how your player is going to come back against you in basketball. And the same way in the jazz, the piano player plays more or less this, but it's not written down. He's making it up. He's going to play that chord change sort of, but he's going to play it on the beat right after the beat with a kind of like Latin feel. You don't know yet. Mm-hmm. So you listen to what happens and you adjust very quickly. I love that part about jazz. One of the interesting characters, well, in the 20s, there were a million jazz composers. Copland was supposed to be a jazz composer.
Right.
I mean, a lot of the French composers, Millot was a French, you know, another
sure,
jazz composer.
A little bit.
The interesting thing was the one who was really deeply jazzy in his heart was George Gershwin. He wasn't a jazz pianist in the sense like Thelonious Monk is, you know, or Duke Ellington, for that matter, who was his contemporary. But he took the soul and the stuff of jazz and put it into his music. And you picked up, Martin, I love this set of variations. I Got Rhythm. That's a set, ding, dong, dong, ding, ding, dong, dong, called rhythm variations. People just say that as a shorthand. George wrote, I Got Rhythm, that simple little tune. Watch the changes he puts it through. This is really a virtuoso exercise. I'm very curious about who you have as our pianist.
William Tritt with the Cincinnati Pops, Eric Kunzel conducting from I Got Rhythm Variations by George Gershwin. Well, there's a trick you can try at home. If you're a pianist of the caliber of William Tritt, he played with the Cincinnati Pops with Eric Kunzel conducting and the I Got Rhythm Variations by George Gershwin.
And let's go out on a piece you mentioned, but we haven't heard, and of course a composer that we all think of, and that's Beethoven. Yeah. Tell us what we're going to hear as we go out.
Yeah, I talked about the passage in the Milan Kundera book, Laughter and Forgetting, where he talks about his father weeping at the sight of Opus 111, which is the last sonata of Beethoven. And the final movement of Beethoven's 32 sonatas is a theme and variations that's so slow. It's a little bit like Goldberg. It seems for the ages.
We're listening to Maurizio Pollini playing the last piano sonata of Beethoven, the piano sonata number 32, which ends with a theme and variations. And theme and variations is the topic we've been discussing with our guest today, Bill McLaughlin. Bill, a pleasure.
Norman, my man, always great to work with you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.